Hello, I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and it's time for our birthdays today. Happy, happy birthday to Jim Hartman of West Des Moines, and very best wishes for happy birthday for Beulah Bloom or Blum of Rockwell. Happy birthday to both of you. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, please give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. And here's a reminder, if you haven't noticed already, that our program schedule has changed pretty dramatically since the beginning of the pandemic. We have moved all of our local papers to a statewide transmission position so that we can get as much local information out to you, to as many of our listeners as possible. So the Fort Dodge Messenger is read every day, Monday through Friday, at 7 a.m. The Mason City Globe Gazette can be heard at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register continues to be read from 9 a.m. to noon every day, with a repeat at 6 p.m. and then again at 1 a.m. the next day. The Cedar Rapids Gazette can be heard at noon 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, you can catch that at 1 p.m. 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald can be heard at 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil is read at 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal is heard on IRIS at 4 p.m. 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune is read at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. And your midweek shopping cart is read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. with repeats throughout the day on Thursday. We're going to stay with this schedule until things get back to normal. So now we're going to get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. Biden opens sign-up window for uninsured. Dateline Washington, this is from the Associated Press. President Joe Biden on Thursday ordered government health insurance markets to reopen for a special sign-up window, offering uninsured Americans a haven as the spread of COVID-19 remains dangerously high and vaccines are not yet widely available. Biden signed an executive order directing the healthcare.gov insurance markets to take new applications for subsidized benefits, something former President Donald Trump's administration had refused to do. He also instructed his administration to consider reversing other Trump healthcare policies, including curbs on abortion counseling and the imposition of work requirements for low-income people who get Medicaid. Quote, "There's nothing new that we're doing here other than restoring the Affordable Care Act and restoring Medicaid to the way it was before Trump became president," Biden said, as he signed the directives in the Oval Office. He declared he was reversing, quote, "my predecessor's attack on women's health," unquote. These actions were only the first steps by Biden, who has promised to build out former President Barack Obama's health care law to achieve a goal of coverage for all. While Biden rejects the idea of a government-run system that Senator Bernie Sanders has pushed for in his Medicare for All proposal, his more centrist approach will require congressional buy-in. But opposition to Obamacare runs deep among Republicans. The most concrete short-term impact of Biden's orders will come from reopening healthcare.gov insurance markets as coverage has shrunk in the economic turmoil of the coronavirus pandemic. That's an executive action and no legislation is required. This new special enrollment period will begin February 15 and run through May 15. It will be coupled with a promotional campaign and a call for states that run their own insurance markets to match this federal sign-up opportunity. Biden also ordered the immediate reversal of a federal policy that bars taxpayer funding for international health care nonprofits that promote or provide abortions. Known as the Mexico City policy, it can be switched off or on depending on whether Democrats or Republicans control the White House. Abortion rights supporters call it the global gag rule. His decision, while expected, was cheered by abortion choice advocates and some humanitarian groups, and it was denounced by anti-abortion groups. The move also included a restoration of American funding to the UN, to the UN Population Fund, and withdraws the U.S. from an international accord that promotes anti-abortion policies. Biden directed the State Department and Department of Health and Human Services to withdraw from the so-called Geneva Consensus, an October 2020 document that was signed by 34 countries that sought to promote anti-abortion policies and others deemed, quote, pro-family worldwide. Next story, on the front page of the USA Today section, the headline is, Results Show Vaccines Are Safe, and this is by Karen Weintraub of USA Today. Early safety data from the first month of COVID-19 vaccinations finds the shots are as safe as the studies suggested. Everyone who experienced an allergic response has been treated successfully, and no other serious problems have turned up among the first 22 million people vaccinated. This is according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The data was collected from several tracking systems, including a voluntary one in which people who were vaccinated reported their symptoms via text. Another allows people who believe they have been harmed by a vaccine to contribute their information. And a third collects reports from medical records. Although it's never possible to prove something is completely safe, data from these tracking systems suggests the vaccines are not causing large numbers of unusual or dangerous results. On Wednesday, Dr. Tom Shimabukuro, who is deputy director of the CDC's Immunization Safety Office, briefed a CDC advisory committee on the agency's review of safety data collected on the two authorized vaccines. More corona, next story from the Associated Press. Virus variant from South Africa in U.S. A new coronavirus variant identified in South Africa has been found in the United States for the first time, with two cases diagnosed in South Carolina, state health officials said Thursday. The cases were discovered in adults in different regions of the state and do not appear to be connected. Neither of the people infected has traveled recently, the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control said. Quote, that's frightening, because it means there could be more undetected cases, said Dr. Krutika Kupali, an infectious disease physician at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. Quote, it's probably more widespread, unquote. The arrival of the variant shows that, quote, the fight against this deadly disease is far from over, said Dr. Brannon Traxler, who is South Carolina's interim public health director. In other developments, COVID-19 deaths of nursing home residents in New York have been undercounted by about 50% as poor infection control practices and understaffing fuel the coronavirus crisis, according to State Attorney General Letitia James. An investigation found the State Department of Health's controversial policy to publicly report COVID-19 deaths of residents only inside nursing homes and withhold deaths of residents transferred to hospitals has hindered attempts to understand the scope of the crisis and improve conditions inside the facilities. The true COVID-19 death toll of nursing home residents is closer to 13,000, as opposed to the 8,677 reported to date by the health department. And that's according to the investigation's findings. Our next bullet point in COVID news. 9 Roman Catholic nuns in southern Michigan have died this month due to a COVID-19 outbreak at their retirement home, which had gone for months without a single case, said a spokeswoman on Thursday. The women lived at the campus of the Adrian Dominican Sisters in Adrian, which is 75 miles southwest of Detroit. COVID-19 has been cited in the deaths of dozens of retired or infirm nuns who live in congregate settings in the U.S. 8 nuns in suburban Milwaukee died of virus complications in 1 week in December. As the variants bring a potential for greater infection risks in the U.S., pandemic-weary lawmakers in several states are pushing back against mask mandates and other protective restrictions ordered by governors. States including Arizona, Michigan, Ohio, Maryland, Kentucky, and Indiana are weighing proposals to limit their governor's abilities to impose emergency restrictions. The Wisconsin legislature was expected to vote on repealing the governor's mask mandate. Pennsylvania lawmakers are considering a constitutional amendment to strip the governor of many of his emergency powers. Governors argue that they need authority to act swiftly in a crisis, and these limitations could slow critical emergency responses. Nebraska could soon eliminate all of its virus-related restrictions on gatherings if the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 continues to decline, even though few people in the state have been vaccinated. Next story in world and national news. Pakistan court release accused killer of Pearl. And this is from Kathy Gannon of the Associated Press. Dateline Islamabad. Pakistan's Supreme Court ordered on Thursday the release of a Pakistani-British man convicted and later acquitted in the beheading of American journalist Daniel Pearl in 2002. The court also dismissed an appeal of Ahmad Saeed Omar Sheikh's acquittal filed by Pearl's family and the Pakistani government. A minister in the Sindhi province, where Sheikh is being held, said the government has exhausted all options to keep him locked up, which is an indication that he could be free within days. The, quote, Supreme Court is the court of last resort, said Murtaza Wahab, Sindh's law minister, to the Associated Press. Quote, the Pearl family is in complete shock by the majority decision of the Supreme Court of Pakistan to acquit and release Ahmed Omar Sheikh and the other accused persons who kidnapped and killed Daniel Pearl, said the Pearl family in a statement released by their attorney. Sheikh was convicted of helping lure Pearl to a meeting in the southern Pakistani port city of Karachi, during which he was kidnapped. And over to Nation and World Watch. Teen charged in fatal shootings of 5 at Indianapolis home. A 17-year-old Indianapolis boy has been charged with murder in the shooting deaths of his father, his stepmother, 2 teenaged relatives, and a 19-year-old pregnant woman in the family's home. This was announced by Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears. Raymond Ronald Lee Childs III was arrested Monday and charged as an adult with 6 counts of murder, including 1 count for the death of the woman's unborn child. The baby was due to be born in a week. Childs also faces an attempted murder charge. Next up in Nation and World Watch, Oklahoma mom of 2 who drowned pleads guilty to child neglect. This is Dateline Tulsa, Oklahoma. An Oklahoma woman whose 2 children wandered from their apartment and drowned has pleaded guilty to reduced charges in the case. Donisha Renee Willis, age 24, agreed Monday to 2 child neglect charges in the May 2020 deaths of 3-year-old Miracle Crook and 21-month-old Tony Crook Jr., according to court records. The charges were reduced from second-degree murder counts. Willis of Tulsa also pleaded guilty to assaulting a police officer for kicking an investigator. She was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And our next piece from Nation and World Watch, Navalny defiant as Russian court rejects his bid for freedom. Dateline Moscow. A Russian court on Thursday rejected an appeal by opposition leader Alexei Navalny for his release from jail, while authorities detained several of his allies and warned social media companies about promoting more protests after tens of thousands demanded his freedom in rallies over the weekend, last weekend. Navalny denounced the proceedings against him as part of a campaign to intimidate the opposition. Quote, "You won't succeed in scaring tens of millions of people who have been robbed by that government," he said. And the last one from Nation and World Watch. WHO team departs quarantine for study of COVID-19 origins. Dateline Wuhan, China. A World Health Organization team emerged from quarantine in the Chinese city of Wuhan on Thursday to start their field work in a fact-finding mission on the origins of the novel coronavirus that caused the COVID-19 pandemic. The researchers, who were required to isolate for 14 days after arriving in China, left their quarantine hotel and headed to another hotel. The mission has become politically charged as China seeks to avoid blame for alleged missteps in its early response to the outbreak. Next story, Biden COVID-19 relief plan faces hurdles. And this is from Nicholas Wu and Rebecca Morin of USA Today, Dateline Washington. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, wants a lower overall price tag. Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, doesn't want a minimum wage increase included. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, still wants a bold and robust bill. Competing interests, a thin House majority, and a Senate composition that gives an enormous amount of power to individual members mean that President Joe Biden faces an uphill climb to pass his $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package. More aid for Americans could be on the chopping block, including a one-year expansion of the child tax credit, $1,400 checks, and a proposal to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. The pending impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump and Republican resistance to the overall price tag also loom large. The argument is centered on a key question. Are all of the bill's provisions related to the pandemic? Representative Tom Reed, a Republican of New York, the co-chair of the Moderate House Problem Solvers Caucus, told reporters Wednesday that the inclusion of the minimum wage increase could make the package seem like it was, quote, contaminated by partisans who wanted to use it as a vehicle to, quote, legislate on things that are not directly related to the crisis. And Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican, Alaska, a key moderate, said the minimum wage increase was important to Democrats, but, quote, really has nothing to do with COVID relief, unquote, pointing instead to provisions like the last package's $300 boost to unemployment benefits as a higher priority agenda item. Biden's proposal includes a broad variety of policy priorities, including $20 billion for national vaccination program, expanding unemployment insurance supplemental payments to $400 a week, expanding to 14 weeks paid sick and family and medical leave, and allocating $25 billion in rental assistance, an additional $5 billion to cover home energy and water costs. Biden and several administration officials have said they are open to negotiating the $1,400 check or the threshold around who will receive it. Quote, well, there's a legitimate reason for people to say, do you have the lines drawn the exact right way? Should it go to anybody making over X number of dollars or why? Biden told reporters Monday. He continued, I'm open to negotiate those things, that's all. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Monday on the Senate floor that the first draft of Biden's proposal, quote, misses the mark. He said he would support a, quote, smart and targeted package rather than what he called an imprecise deluge of borrowed money. And key Senate Republicans like Collins have concurred. She told reporters Monday She wanted a package that would, quote, focus solely on the pandemic rather than include a wish list of Democratic priorities, like the increase to the minimum wage, though she said she would support debate over the minimum wage in a separate bill. Despite the Biden administration's openness to negotiate, Biden indicated it might be difficult to take out certain policies from the package. Quote, I'm reluctant to cherry pick and take out one or two items here and then have to go through it again because these are all kind of, they go sort of hand in glove, every one of these issues, he said. Schumer signaled Wednesday that he might move forward without Republican support anyway. Quote, we must not repeat the mistakes of 2008 and 2009 when Congress was too timid to confront the national crisis, he said, referring to the federal government's relief packages passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. The Biden administration wants to pass the relief package in the next month. Biden said on Monday that time is of the essence. Quote, there's an urgency to moving it forward, and he certainly believes that there needs to be progress in the next couple of weeks, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said on Monday. And here's another one from USA Today, writer Marion Callahan, and the title is COVID-19 Vaccine Rollout Can Sideline Family Doctors. Call your primary care doctor first. That's the direction patients are typically given when they're facing a non-emergency medical situation. But in the case of securing the COVID-19 vaccine, many primary care physicians and their patients have been left in the dark. Thousands of calls have flooded private doctors' offices across Pennsylvania since the rollout of the vaccine. Yet primary care physicians who are not affiliated with hospitals are among the last in line to receive and distribute the vaccine to patients, said medical leaders. Dr. Keith Saddell, who owns and operates a private family practice in Upper Southampton, filed his paperwork to get the vaccine for his patients and submitted the required forms 2 months ago. Still no vaccine. Quote, when I see that some of my patients who are young and healthy and are not healthcare workers are getting the vaccine at Rite Aid, while my patients who are 65 years and older cannot get the vaccine, and they look to me, this is as frustrating as you can imagine, he said. Saddell cares for about 4,000 patients, most of whom are elderly and have medical conditions. Quote, I do not understand why pharmacies are placed over physicians to deliver the vaccine, unquote. He is not alone. The federal government has largely left vaccine rollout to the states and public health departments, and Pennsylvania, like many states, is relying on hospitals to be the main distribution point. Pennsylvania last week opened up vaccine eligibility to anyone 65 and older and adults with pre-existing medical conditions, which spiked demand despite dwindling supply. On Tuesday, Governor Tom Wolf expressed frustration with the government's coronavirus vaccine rollout, saying Pennsylvania needs 6.5 million more individual doses just to complete full vaccination of everyone in the current 1A phase of the state's plan. Yet there are questions about whether the state and its counties are making use of all the vaccines delivered so far. An online report from Becker's Hospital Review ranked Pennsylvania 42nd out of 50 states in percentage of vaccine doses received that have been administered. Of the approximately 1.6 million vaccines delivered to the state, about 800,000 have not yet been given, according to data from the state and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Quote, if they give us 1,000 vaccines tonight, I'd have it in 1,000 arms this week, said Hatboro family doctor Harris Cohen, who has the refrigeration and staff in place to give the Moderna vaccine, one of two that has received emergency use approval from the Food and Drug Administration. Only a fraction of the vaccines distributed so far have gone to primary care physicians, according to the state's list of approved providers. At the same time, confusion about how to sign up for a shot has left many Pennsylvanians frustrated, and those at high risk of serious complications from COVID-19 continue to wait, with little news on when they will be inoculated. That confusion has translated into about 100 calls a day flooding Cohen's family practice, which is called Hatboro Medical Associates. Quote, "This is the most important health issue we have right now, yet there are so many roadblocks," he said. "Every patient I see asks about it, and I don't have an answer. It reminds me of the testing shortage in early March," unquote. Medical leaders are calling on President Joe Biden to direct states to get vaccines to physicians' practices. In a January 26 letter, Haley Fisher Wright, CEO of Medical Group Management, cited a survey that showed 85% of independent practices and 45% of hospital or health system-owned practices actively seeking the COVID vaccine for their patients, reporting having none obtained to date. And this one's from the Associated Press. Pelosi pressures GOP over Green. Georgia representative supported posts advocating violence against the Democrats and the FBI. Dateline Washington. Speaker Nancy Pelosi intensified pressure Thursday on House Republican leaders for their handling of a controversial GOP freshman, denouncing them for placing a lawmaker who Pelosi said has mocked the killing of little children on the chamber's education committee. Pelosi's comments focused on Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, whose views were in the spotlight even before she joined the House this month. Greene supported Facebook posts that advocated violence against Democrats and the FBI. One suggested shooting Pelosi in the head. In response to a post raising the prospect of hanging former President Barack Obama, Greene responded that, quote, "the stage is being set." On Thursday, Pelosi referred to social media posts reported by Media Matters for America, which is a liberal watchdog group, in which Greene pushed conspiracy theories or hit like on posts that challenged the veracity of mass shootings at schools in Newtown, Connecticut, and Parkland, Florida. Quote, "assigning her to the education committee when she has mocked the killing of little children at those schools, what could they be thinking? Or is thinking too generous a word for what they might be doing?" Pelosi said of Republican leaders. She continued, quote, "it's absolutely appalling." Although some Republicans have condemned Greene's postings, they were hardly a surprise. Greene has expressed support for QAnon conspiracy theories, which focus on the belief that top Democrats are involved in child sex trafficking, Satan worship, and cannibalism. Facebook videos surfaced last year showing that she expressed racist, anti-Semitic, and anti-Muslim views. Top Republicans denounced her at the time, hoping to block her from winning the GOP nomination for her reliably red congressional district in Northwest Georgia. The opposition faded, however, when Greene won the primary and was essentially guaranteed a seat in Congress. By the time she was sworn into office, Greene had ridden with former President Donald Trump on Air Force One during his final days in office. Republican leaders are now confronting a conundrum of their own making. The party largely embraced Greene after she won the primary, which makes it harder for them to distance themselves from her, especially when many of her views are well known. CNN reported on Greene's Facebook posts, which have since been deleted. She tweeted responses before the story was published that didn't dispute their authenticity or disavow them, saying instead, quote, "many posts have been liked, many posts have been shared, some did not represent my views," unquote. Still, there's greater pressure on political leaders to address extremism after a mob of Trump supporters staged a deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. California Democratic Representative Jimmy Gomez announced Wednesday night that he was readying a resolution to expel Green from Congress because of her post, or excuse me, because of her past social media activity. In a statement to Axios, a spokesman for House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy called the posts, quote, deeply disturbing, and said McCarthy, quote, plans to have a conversation with the congresswoman about them. It's unknown when that might happen. Republican National Committee Chairwoman Rona McDaniel called the posts disgusting, adding that they have no place in our party and should be looked into. But McDaniel also spoke to a QAnon issue that goes beyond Green. Quote, I think it's really important, after what's just happened in our country, that we have some self-reflection on the violence that's continuing to erupt, she said in an interview. I think QAnon is beyond fringe. I think it's dangerous. We should be looking at that and making sure we don't mince words. And when we say that we can't support groups that are initiating violence, unquote. On Wednesday night, a reporter from WRCB-TV attempted to ask Green about her social media posts during a public town hall in Dalton, Georgia. The reporter was kicked out of the event and threatened with arrest by a sheriff's deputy. The Whitfield County Sheriff's Office declined to comment and directed questions to Green's office. A spokesperson for Green's office said in a statement, "This was a town hall for constituents, not a press conference." The FBI has called QAnon a domestic terrorism threat, and the Department of Homeland Security issued a national terrorism bulletin Wednesday, warning of the potential for lingering violence from extremists enraged by President Joe Biden's election and emboldened by the January 6 attack on the Capitol. Green's online agitation goes beyond past Facebook posts, including making a video that suggested the 2017 Las Vegas mass shooting, which killed 58 people, was staged to advance gun control legislation. Since winning her congressional seat, Green has sought to capitalize on her growing national notoriety with conservatives, spending more than $206,000 to lure in new donors through Parler, which is a social media site that's favored by Trump supporters. The site was effectively booted from the internet following the mayhem at the Capitol after Amazon, which hosted the site, decided that Parler wasn't doing enough to police users who incite violence. Before its removal, Green's spending supercharged her presence on Parler, with some of her posts reaching millions of users, according to an analysis of data by the Associated Press. She frequently attacked Democrats and railed against coronavirus pandemic safety measures, like mask wearing. Green also called on Congress to overturn the results of Biden's election victory. Quote, I'm tired of seeing weak-kneed Republicans play defense. I will go on the attack, Green said in a November 18 post. Quote, it's our 1776 moment, she posted the day before the mob overran our Capitol. Green is now texting supporters, trying to raise money for her attempt to, quote, impeach Biden. The fine print of her solicitations, however, show that any funds she takes in will instead be routed to her campaign account. And we're a little behind, but it's time to switch over to the opinions. This is the Register's editorial for today. Headline, Doctor, Health workers, get vaccinated. It's kind of confusing. I don't know. And they write, on Tuesday afternoon, Register editorial writer Andy Dominic caught up again with Dr. Tom Benzoni, who is a local emergency room physician. We've interviewed him more than a dozen times since the coronavirus hit Iowa. Here are some edited excerpts from our January 26 conversation. Register asks, what's going on at hospitals? Answer, we're definitely seeing signals in Iowa that the general population is wearing masks. I don't care what somebody gets on a stump and says. Iowans are doing better. We're seeing fewer COVID patients. We're seeing lower and lower numbers. I'm seeing no seasonal flu, and I'm testing for it. That's because people are masking, washing, and distancing. The Register asks, well, leaders at the Iowa Capitol refused to impose a mask mandate, and some lawmakers are not wearing masks. What advice do you have for people who want to stay as safe as possible, but must work there? And he answers, first, I heard one lawmaker say he supposedly could not enforce a mask mandate. Son, if you're in a leadership position and you can't get your people to do the right thing, maybe we need to get somebody in there who knows how to do it. There's no excuse for that. Your First Amendment rights do not extend to threatening the public good. As for people who must work there, properly wear a mask and do not share air vapor. The State House is full of air vapor or hot air. Politicians make their living by talking, and talking is what makes a super spreader situation. The Register asks, help me understand the virus mutations in these new variants that may be more transmissible or deadly. His answer, when the virus replicates, it's replicating in your cells. You replicate the virus and mistakes are made, just like when you're sending a text and make an error. The virus does not have autocorrect, so those mistakes or mutations are published and they propagate. Most mistakes are fatal to the virus and do not replicate, but every once in a while, a mutation gives the virus a survival advantage. Register's question, so what does that mean for current vaccines? And his answer, it means going forward, we could all be looking at something like the seasonal flu vaccine, which is reformulated every year. What's especially cool about the COVID vaccine using messenger RNA is that scientists do not have to start from scratch to modify it. Once they have the map of the mutated virus, they can sit down at a computer keyboard and tweak the existing vaccine. There's more to it than that, but you get the general idea. And remember, people who've had 10 years of sequential seasonal flu vaccines do better in their 11th year than somebody getting the vaccine for the first time. You really don't start new each time. Your immune system has already accumulated memory of the years before. Question, why should healthcare workers get a COVID vaccine? Answer, that's what smart people do. Smart people protect themselves. Don't you wear your seatbelt? I do not intend to get into a car wreck, but you can bet I'm wearing my seatbelt. Question, do you support employers in the health sector requiring vaccinations for their workers? His answer, absolutely. Health workers who refuse to be vaccinated should go find other jobs. They should not be in healthcare. They will be putting others at unnecessary risk. Truly being a health worker means putting your patients before yourself. It's a fiduciary relationship. When at work, you have a clear, unquestioned responsibility to put others before yourself. What you do privately should correspond to that. Question from the Register. I read President Joe Biden has directed the Federal Emergency Management Agency to begin establishing community vaccination centers, aiming to be in operation soon. You are a medical manager with FEMA. How would those centers work? And Dr. Benzoni answers, first, let's go back to civics. What is the United States? What is a confederation? It's the states getting together. That's the con in confederation. The federal government does not exist outside us. It is us. That profound idea has been missing. The governor would have to permit FEMA's entry. But when states work together, there is a tremendous advantage. I don't know what exactly Biden is coming up with for a plan, but FEMA knows how to move stuff. How do you move vaccine around the country? That's what FEMA does. How do you drop ship the right amount of vials, the right number of vials and syringes to the right locations? That's what FEMA does. So that Register editorial was this conversation that happened on January 26th between the register, writer Andy Dominic and Dr. Tom Benzoni, who works in an emergency room here in Des Moines. Okay, letters to the editor. Our first letter is from, I'm going to mess this up, Srileka Kundu of Des Moines. I'm going to spell the first name, Srileka. And they write, mental health is central to well-being. The topic of mental health is often overlooked and unfortunately considered taboo in many instances. However, now is prime time to be educated about what mental health is. What does it mean to be mentally healthy? How does one know that their mental health is deteriorating? When does a person pursue help to better their mental health status? There are so many of these personal mental health questions that the majority of our population does not acknowledge. Perhaps this is the case because they fear judgment or because they simply do not know how to be in touch with their mental health. Both of these mental blocks are, in my opinion, normal and understandable, but we must be able to recognize and combat these blocks that we often place on ourselves. During times as straining as these, we rely on and need each other more than ever. It's crucial we not forget that. If we are not well, we cannot be there for others. And that was from Srileka Kundu of Des Moines. Next letter to the editor. Tax cuts come with a price tag. This is from Jerry Ullman of Carlisle. And he writes, I would agree with Governor Kim Reynolds that the Iowa legislature needs to remove the tax triggers adopted in 2018. However, I would not agree that Iowans need another tax cut that will go mostly to Iowa's wealthiest individuals at the expense of lower income Iowans. Cuts in income tax have always led to increases in sales and property taxes, and that just transfers the tax burden onto Iowa's poorest people. Iowa's rural roads already suffer from poor maintenance, as do our highways and secondary roads. Iowa's bridges are among the worst in the nation and require replacement and repair. Iowa needs to make a stronger commitment to education, clean water, cleaner air, and renewable energy sources, as well as better land management. We need a greater commitment to Iowa's mental health facilities, the prison system, and juvenile detention facilities. From help and the revitalization of small town Iowa communities to delivering broadband services throughout the state, the list is long. The estimated revenue loss is too great at a time when Iowa could use much more. None of the things Iowa needs to keep our population and attract further development and industry with better paying jobs will be funded by cutting taxes for Iowa's wealthiest. And that letter from Jerry Ullman of Carlisle. And our final letter to the editor for today is from Al Charlson of Waverly, and that's Charlson. He writes, virus, not political opponents, is our adversary. I certainly agree with Governor Kim Reynolds about the importance of enabling students to attend in-person classes. Our grandchildren tell us they really prefer being in class to online learning whenever we visit with them by FaceTime. I'm very surprised that the governor is not using the COVID-19 vaccination program to help make that possible. After healthcare workers and nursing home residents and staff, the next highest priority group to receive vaccinations should be teachers and school support staff members and parents and other adults living in the same household with students. Childcare providers should also be included in that group. That prioritization of vaccinations could help students get back to school safely and make it easier for parents to go to work. Strategic use of the COVID-19 vaccination program would be a more positive and helpful way to get students back in the classroom full time than a mandate that really does nothing to deal with our real adversary, which is the virus. And that was from Al Charlson of Waverly. And the political cartoon today is from Joey Weatherford of the Tribune Content Agency. and it shows, it's black and white, and it shows the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, and there's Bernie in a lawn chair on the left-hand side of the frame. He's sitting in that famous shot of him with a mask on wearing his mittens. And then to the right of him are two guards, fully armed. And the thought bubble is coming from one of the guards, and he says, "I don't know why he's still out here after the inauguration, but at least he's warm." So that's your political cartoon. That's just for Kirsten. And another piece from the opinion page of the Des Moines Register today, titled, "Why Competition for Public Schools is a Fallacy." And this is the Your Turn article from guest columnist Carrie Lust, or Lust, L-U-S-T. It says Carrie and her family live in Ankeny. And she there's a photo of a young man smiling. She writes, "This is my son, Brandon. He's an amazing 13-year-old boy with autism. Brandon, his brother, and his sister all attend public school in Ankeny. Once again, the phrase, quote, school choice has come up in the Iowa legislature. There is a bill this session that deals with school vouchers, Senate File 159. Be aware of the different terminology that seems to come up each session. Student first scholarships or education savings accounts, they're all vouchers. This proposal would allow parents to use Iowa taxpayer money to send their children to private schools. Because of my son's special needs, private schools will not accept him. They are allowed to discriminate against him and pick and choose which students they decide to educate. When you hear the term school choice, remember, there are thousands of Iowa children like Brandon who have no choice. This bill would not change that. The ones with the true choice are the private school administrators and charter school administrators who get to choose which students to accept. They have every right to do that. But if they begin to receive tax dollars, then they should be held to the same standards as public schools. You may hear that competition is good for public schools. That's a fallacy. Public schools cannot raise their own revenue. They're dependent on taxpayer dollars. Private schools can raise tuition. Public schools must educate every student. Private schools can pick and choose who they want to accept. You may hear private schools emphasize their excellent test scores. You may also hear about failing schools. Children with special needs, like my son, do not always test well. My son's test scores drag down the average at his school. My son is more than a test score. Every child is. Does that mean his public school is failing? Absolutely not. My son is surrounded by amazing teachers and associates. He has made unbelievable progress during his time in school. However, he will always have autism, and he will always have to work harder than neurotypical kids to make progress. I can't stand by and be silent when it is proposed that tax dollars be taken away from my son's only choice in education and given to private schools that are allowed to reject him because of his diagnosis. If you feel the same way, please contact your local legislators. The proposal under consideration would dismantle Iowa's public education system and harm children like my son." And that's from Carrie Lust of Ankeny. And I'm going to go over to the USA Today website, pick up some more opinions on the national side. April Poneru, who's an opinion contributor, writes this to the USA Today opinion page. "Virginia fails to protect the elderly. My parents caught COVID while vaccines languish unused." She writes, "Like many older people, my parents live with a number of health challenges. This week, I discovered they suffer from an additional risk, which is living in Fairfax County, Virginia. 11 years ago, when my parents moved from Scottsdale, Arizona, to be near their grandchildren in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C., We took comfort in the fact that Fairfax County offers an excellent standard of living, including top-notch medical care. It's one of the wealthiest, most highly educated counties in the country. When COVID hit last spring, we joined millions of families across the country in taking precautions to keep our loved ones safe. We felt relief when a vaccine was announced. We'd nearly made it to safety. But bad news came just after the new year, when my 81-year-old father-in-law, who had recently moved to an assisted living facility in Missouri, tested positive for COVID-19. Thankfully, after a week-long hospital stay, he was released and is on the path to recovery. Our family seemed to have made it through COVID, and soon we would all be vaccinated. My siblings and I determined to get our parents in the front of the line for a vaccine. I told my mother to let her doctor know that she wanted to be added to the list. 80 years old and in fragile health, Mom was told by her doctor that she would have to sign up for the vaccine with the county once registration was open online. Fine. We waited. Excuse me. We waited on the county health department's website for announcements about vaccine eligibility, and we scoured the fine print as soon as they came out. Her age put her in the second eligible group, phase 1B, just behind healthcare workers. On January 12th, my dad sent in the form and we waited for that call. It never came. The health department warned on its website that my mom's group included approximately 150,000 people. My father, in his early 70s, would have to wait even longer. After a few days, we decided to make some calls on our own. The health department explained that there were no openings, that we would just have to be patient. Vaccination has been maddeningly slow in Virginia. As of January 25, we have the highest percentage of unused vaccines in the nation. My parents were left unprotected, not because there wasn't enough vaccine available, but because there wasn't a sensible plan in place. As the languid pace continued, I read reports that school teachers, many of whom have not taught in classrooms since last spring, were being prioritized for vaccines. At the same time, their union was making demands. Teachers, vaccinated teachers, should not have to return to classrooms even in the fall. And maybe not even this calendar year. The union stated that all school children must be vaccinated too before teachers should return to school. Never mind that there's no vaccine that has even been approved for children under 16. And still, we waited, no call. On Saturday, January 22nd, my dad told me he wasn't feeling well. Because it was a weekend, we encouraged him to get a telehealth appointment with a local clinic that we had used before. We sent him the link and he got an appointment the same day. The doctor prescribed him a Z-Pak to help with his upper respiratory symptoms and ordered him to get a COVID test from a mobile testing center. The next day, it came back positive. Our challenge was now more complicated. How do we take care of Dad while keeping Mom safe? The doctor didn't want Mom to rush out for a test. Cold air is hard on her lungs and she doesn't drive much anymore. We were told to watch for symptoms. My sister and I urged Mom to stay with one of us while my father recovered. No way. She wasn't about to leave her husband of 49 years when he was sick. They would do their best to isolate from each other while sharing a home. My sister, my husband, and I gathered items from our home that could be helpful to them. We ran to the drugstore twice, the grocery store, and made a million phone calls. On Monday, I loaded my car with meals made by a dear friend and get well cards crafted by my children, and I drove to my parents' home. At the door, Mom looked tired and worried. I asked her if she was feeling okay. Her asthma had been acting up, and she insisted she was fine. "It's hard for you not being with Dad, isn't it?" Her lip quivered, her eyes filled with tears, and she nodded. The next day, January 26, Mom had a scheduled telehealth appointment. My parents used my dad's smartphone for these appointments, which made keeping the appointment almost comically complicated. Dad had to clean his phone with alcohol wipes and explain from yards away what button to push. When Mom accidentally hit the wrong button, they had to start over. Once online, the medical team noticed that her breathing was labored and told her to go to the emergency room. My sister raced over, double masked and windows down. I met them there, we checked her in, and we waited. A few hours later, she had a chest x-ray, a positive COVID test, and immediate transfer to another hospital where she received monoclonal antibody infusion. Our area's hospital system has just said it's canceling first dose vaccination appointments in response to a change in state directives. Governor Ralph Northam said there will soon be a statewide registry so that people can learn when they will get a vaccine, quote, even if the answer is they can't get an appointment for a month or two, unquote. For my family, though, the snafus no longer matter. Mom and Dad are home today, and at least they are finally able to care for each other. My siblings and I are worried about them. We'll spend the coming days trying to get my dad a monoclonal antibody infusion. We'll be monitoring their symptoms, bringing them the things they need. My family, all of us, are doing our part. Millions of families are making countless sacrifices to try to keep those around them safe. It's baffling and infuriating that our government has not done the same. And that was an opinion piece, a letter sent in by April Ponneru, who lives in Alexandria, Virginia. And that brings us to the end of the second hour of the Des Moines Register for Friday, January 29. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, it will be time for obituaries.